Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Let me start by just previewing what we're going to be doing this week, and probably will roll over into next week as well. We're going to be discussing some of the top science breakthroughs in, health and medicine over the last few months, the last 12 months, to be exact. And I hope that you will enjoy that. Some of the topics that we'll be including are findings that slow Huntington's disease for the first time, scientists saving a baby's life using personalized gene therapy, a vaccine that seems to reduce the risk of dementia, and evidence that COVID vaccine may actually boost cancer therapy. So we'll be talking about that and many, many more things. This one is from Liz in Durham, North Carolina. Liz writes, I'm a 72-year-old female, long time listener. Love you, in parentheses, in good health, but I have concerns about memory loss. I have been struggling for 3+ years to get my omega-3 levels up. I'm tracking my blood work as tested by Bill Harris's company, OmegaQuant. Fish oil tablets are expensive, and the blood work costs two times a year costs a fair amount as well. I'm only now barely in the acceptable range of 7.89 on their scale, and have been taking 4 of the 1,000 milligram of the tablets labeled fish oil sold at Costco every day. My questions are, do you have any suggestions, and would purslane help? Well, Liz, purslane, I'm just going to answer briefly because I haven't had a chance to look at the articles that you sent for my information, but I'll pick that topic up next week. If I find anything that's different than what I'm about to say. Purslane is a leafy green, and leafy greens have lots of antioxidant properties, and antioxidants are very good for brain preservation. I don't know that there's anything in purslane that makes it specifically unique. A lot of times these science articles will, just by nature of the way we do science, they have to pick one thing and test it. Also, studies can vary so much in their method sections and their statistics that I'd have to read those studies, and I didn't really have time to do that while I was preparing for the show today. So I want you to know I heard you, and I will go to work on answering your question, that part of your question. But I do want to talk about the omega-3 issue. And the first thing you need to know is that since you're 72, you probably have Medicare, and most of the standard laboratories that that take Medicare do use the same testing that OmegaQuant does. There's nothing particularly special about that company. With all due respect, you can use a testing service that might work out to be a lot cheaper for you. Another comment I'll make is that the standards that a proprietary lab like this sets for something may be a little higher to kind of keep you coming back. But I think the level of omega-3, whether that level is correct, depends on whether they're doing the omega-3 index or whether they're doing the omega-3, omega-6 ratio. And those would be interpreted very differently. So I'd need to know more about what that specific 7.98 was to be able to interpret it. But let's, as you said, say that you got into their acceptable range. So the first thing to do is to take a look at those Costco capsules and see how much EPA and DHA are in your capsules. Because 1,000 milligrams of omega-3 is nice, but the stuff that's active in the brain is mainly the DHA. So for people who are having brain issues, I will encourage them to get at least 1,000 milligrams of DHA. And that you'll just have to look at the bottle of what you're taking and do the math. Other omega-3s are not as valuable, and some of the capsules that just say omega-3 on them actually have fairly low levels of DHA, and you need to check. So 1,000 milligrams of DHA would be ideal. The thing about taking your 4,000, you may be thinning your blood a little bit too much for surgery with that, despite the fact that you're not benefiting your brain so much as you might hope. So it's important to stop for 10 days before any surgical procedure, because the 4,000 milligrams of omega-3 will have an effect in the bloodstream of slowing down the platelets, which are your first line at blood clotting. And I want to just parenthetically state, there are so many other things to do for memory loss. Probably the two most important things, beyond the obvious good sleep and a good diet with lots of leafy greens, is good glucose control. So people who get their hemoglobin A1C, you know, we want to see that number below 5.6, ideally 5.4 and below. And that can mean giving up sweets and sugar and starch in order to get it down there. But your brain, it's just this bizarre thing, but the same enzyme that breaks down insulin in your brain also is responsible for breaking down beta amyloid, which is the protein that accumulates in Alzheimer's disease. So you want to be able to have plenty of free enzyme around to cut up that beta amyloid so that it goes down the proper metabolic pathway and doesn't sludge up the corridors of your neurons like, you know, hoarder news piles of newspaper might do in a house. Another thing that's very important is raising your brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF. And that can be raised by weight training. If you stimulate the muscles such that you're building muscles, you will be actually raising your levels of this thing, which in your brain causes you to make new synapses and helps you with memory and learning. Because a lot of what we call memory is really that we're not creating new synapses to allow us to recall recent events or things that you want to remember. They're not staying in storage. They're not going into storage, I should say. When you see something that your brain wants to remember, it whirls around in an electrical circuit of neurons. It's kind of a buffer, if you will. And that buffer transforms the neurons into forming new synapses, and those synapses are what you use to store what you are trying to remember. So it's very important to have adequate levels of that compound in the brain. So a little bit of resistance work, and you want to do that in a controlled fashion. There's lots of books and videos and classes. Your local senior center, you're in a large enough town, I'm sure that the local hospitals have good weight training classes for seniors that can help you out with just materials that you can put together from your home. I'll never forget being in Bali and looking from my window at the homestay where I was out to the yard where the young teenage boys of the family had put together a fairly respectable weight room just using poles and water bottles filled with sand and various other MacGyver-esque kind of things, but they were doing the work, and it was just fun to see just the inventiveness of those young people. And I think that just because you're 72, that doesn't mean you can't be equally inventive. So I hope that's helpful. If you'd like to give me a call or ask a question or make a comment, I'd love to hear from you. 831-900-5773 or on air at ksqd.org. And let's go with some interesting things that came out this year. This was Popular Science's grand prize of the innovations of 2025 in healthcare. And it's eye drops that correct age-related farsightedness for up to 10 hours at a time. Presbyopia is what the technical term is for, you know, the reason that when you hit your 40s or your 50s, you start needing reading glasses because you can't see up close. Something like 128 million people have this, and it's a large percentage of the population, pretty much goes along with aging sooner or later. But now an eye drop developed by Lens Therapeutics offers presbyopic patients vision correction for 10 hours at a time. The name of the agent in the eye drop is ACECLIDINE. I would basically say that's aceclidine, but maybe it's aceclidine. That's harder to say. They're both hard to say, actually. It was previously known in Europe. It wasn't available in the United States, but it was an it was just one of the many drugs that you use for glaucoma. And it works on the iris by making the pupil smaller. In the case of presbyopia or farsightedness of age, the smaller the pupil, the greater the depth of field. You may, if you're a photographer, understand that connection. The aperture of the lens determines the depth of field. And they had trials to validate this. People were aged 45 to 75, and they improved people's near vision by three or more lines on the eye charts within 30 minutes, just by making the pupil smaller. The participants could then suddenly read phones and tablets without reading glasses, and they had no loss to their distance vision. Results lasted for, as we've said, 10 hours. There were some side effects. This drug works differently. Previous drugs, which have failed mostly, work on the ciliary muscle, which bends the lens behind the iris. But the problem is, if you stimulate a muscle, you're going to get muscle spasm. And a lot of people got brow pain from this because it fused into their other muscles. The most commonly reported issues with VIS are eye irritation, dimming of vision. Well, that makes sense because you've just affected your night vision, which involves widening the pupil, redness and headache. So where I think this could be really useful would be in situations where you're just don't want to have to use your glasses, or you're doing something that doesn't, where you need to see up close, and yet at the same time, your glasses are an encumbrance. Maybe if you're wearing, for example, a mask, because you're in a clinical situation where you need the mask, or, you know, a professional situation of any kind, and your lenses are fogging up. Another thing that crosses my mind is if you're trying to scuba dive with glasses, it's no bueno, and getting a custom mask is very expensive. Other things that happened in 2025, babies are far more likely to die waiting for a heart transplant. And there's more than 1,000 children on the wait list. And there's a small donor pool, as we might imagine. Children don't die that often. And so up to 20% of children die while waiting for a heart transplant. So they were looking for a way to widen the donor pool. Right now, you have to have a heart that is still beating, but if you have a heart that stopped beating, that's called circulatory death. There has been difficulty in getting that to work as well, and there's been something called normothermic regional perfusion, which reanimates a heart within the body of the person. But then, how do we define death if you've resuscitated the heart? And so that just is a non-starter. So a team at Duke University developed an on-table reanimation technique. It's a special circuit, kind of like a defibrillator, I guess, that reanimates the circulatory death heart. So we've checked all the ethical boxes, and it gets around the restrictions. And if it was adopted more widely, it's estimated that it could save many children's lives and improve the donor pool by up to 20%. Still too small for the need. They were successful in transplanting a heart from a one-month-old donor to a six-month-old recipient. And wow, that sounds great. Now, this one that happened in 2025 is near and dear to my heart. A milestone study published this year. Actually, of course, the early work was going on for years before that, but we're counting it because this is the one that saved my husband's life, and this is the one that came out this year. And this is CAR-T immunotherapy that's yielding long-term remission and survival for multiple myeloma patients. So out of 97 treated patients, one-third had their cancer disappear completely and was still disappeared at 5 years. Actually, it's a bit more than one-third. It was 38%. And these were in people who were very sick. They'd had their multiple myeloma for as long as 6 or 7 years. They'd been through multiple therapies, multiple chemos. They had to fail everything else before they qualified for this study. And that meant that they were very, very, very tired and very debilitated by the time they went into this. So having such a striking disease-free survival interval is really impressive. If you think about just total survival, that was over 50%. The therapy works by actually removing the disease-fighting T cells from the person's body and then changing them so that they multiply, but basically takes them back to a less differentiated state, sort of not quite a stem cell, but, kind of an adolescent stem cell rather than a baby stem cell. And so they then retrain them using CRISPR, which allows for gene editing. And they edited them so that they made a receptor for one of the antigens, which is almost always positive on the surface of these cancer cells. Multiple myeloma is a very strange disease because the cell that becomes cancerous is a cell that normally just hangs out in the bone marrow and makes antibodies. So when you vaccinate someone, what they do is they make some of these plasma cells and they become memory cells and they go and live in the bone marrow and they churn out antibody. But when it's a cancer, those antibodies don't work. They're flawed and there's too many of them. So it floods the bloodstream with protein and actually increases the viscosity. The majority of people with multiple myeloma are diagnosed when they either break a bone because the bone marrow in that bone is so infiltrated by cancer, or when they have a stroke because their blood has become so thick that it can't circulate through the small vessels in the brain. So this is just amazing, and the therapy was, in my own personal life, miraculous. Now let's go for something that's high impact but low tech. And that's a study that was done about blood pressure. It's published by UC Davis Health, my old alma mater. And they looked at a organized remote patient monitoring program. The program itself is 6 months long. It uses take-home technology that people can do on their own, and that it's basically covered by insurance. It includes education, medication, and working with the doctor remotely to make sure you're on a medication that's well-tolerated, that you'll take. Also, blood pressure cuffs for at-home monitoring. Each patient gets an orientation, group classes, individual coaching about best practices for their health, including that might be, diet and other behavior changes. But a year in, This study, just published, cites an average drop in people's blood pressure from 150 over 80 to 125 over 74 in only a few months. This is just everyday tech with community support and access to advice. Really amazing stuff. Another amazing bit of invention, something called the NanoKnife. It's a minimally invasive intervention for prostate cancer. Prostate cancer, as we live longer and don't die of heart disease, 1 in 8 men will be diagnosed with prostate cancer in their lifetimes. And the treatment can include surgery and radiation. Often these interventions damage the nerves surrounding the tumor and can lead to problems like erectile dysfunction, urinary incontinence, other issues as well. The NanoKnife actually uses localized electrical pulses. So it's essentially like skewering the cancer with a very thin wire and then electrocuting the cancer cells. And they can tell exactly how far it's going to penetrate. So they know what the level of distribution of cell death is going to be, so they can avoid damage to the neighboring tissues. And most of the nerves that get damaged in the prostate surgeries are on the outside of the prostate in the capsule. So if you just puncture the capsule and go straight for the tumor and apply this rapid electrical pulse, you fry the tumor without frying the prostate. It only works for men with prostate cancer that hasn't yet spread, but it has real interest in terms of what we're going to see. So more stories. This one's, I think before we go to the next set of stories, I just want to point out that it's been a tough year for medicine. United States research has been at the very top of its game for decades. But it's recently been scrambled by a series of political decisions that are going to have long-reaching consequences. Science didn't stop, and medicine has had its share of major advances this year. But that's largely due to the momentum of previous decades of rational decision-making by both political parties. And what can we say? That ship appears to have sailed. But what makes 2025 unique is how innovative it is. There's a potent new weapon for AIDS, HIV. There's just so many new things. So let's talk about a couple of them. I'm going to save the gene editing of the baby for the second half of the program. So I'll skip down to a few new medications. A few stand out every year, and we're going to talk about those. Gilead has come up with a drug called Yeztugo, which is used for the prevention of HIV. It's an extended method of PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis with agents like Truvada has made a huge difference in the number of people who are at risk for HIV, not getting it because they are taking an agent that essentially acts as a birth control for the HIV virus. But the Trump administration has dismantled USAID, and there are other cuts to HIV prevention programs. So this drug may not have the impact that it should have. But there is an agreement between the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria that could provide the drug for 2 million people in resource-limited countries for the next 3 years. What is Yeztugo? Well, it's an injection that's taken twice a year, and it because it only has to be given subcutaneous twice a year, it's very easier to do in resource-limited countries where people might be in outlying villages. You can imagine it's a bit like a vaccination in the sense that you load up the fridge, throw it in the back of the Jeep, and ride out to the isolated area and just give people who are at risk the vaccination, so in quotes, and then later on they get another shot 6 months later, it's 99% effective, which is huge, and you don't have to worry about people's compliance. And we know that in the United States, Gilead is charging through the nose $14,000 per injection. However, that's what the opening salvo is with insurance companies. However, they are using that money to fund access in the third world, and that is a pretty good trade-off, I think. Another thing that was approved this year is a new non-opioid that's designed for treatment of moderate to severe acute pain. So I'll just give you a little anecdote. The drug in question is called Jurnovax, and it's suzetrigine. So think journal, except VX instead of the L on the end. That's the brand name. And then the drug itself is suzetrigine, if you want to look it up. It is the first in its class. It works on sodium channels in the peripheral nervous system, essentially interfering, similar to the way that lidocaine interferes when you inject it around a nerve, or Novocaine. It interferes with the ability of that nerve to send the pain signal up the spinal column into the brain. So it stops it in its tracks before it even gets to the brain. It's currently been approved for acute pain. And what would that be? That would be surgical pain, right? So a person has a surgery and let's suppose that they are they've been a heroin addict and they are unwilling to have any opioids go through their system, and yet they need pain control. So that would be a situation where a person would want to use this agent. Another reason you might want to use it is people who have a family history of that, and they're just worried that they would also be vulnerable due to genetics. We do see that. We see people who've never had a problem with addiction, and they get one prescription of 30 Vicodin for surgery, tooth extraction, and become hooked on what technically would be a very, very small amount of drugs. So there's something going on in those individuals, and it's probably hereditary. It runs in families, so you might want to avoid this drug. So I see it as having a reasonable amount of use. It does show a superiority to placebo. These trials were looking at double-blind placebo control, active controls. So they were also comparing it to other agents, and it found it to be non-inferior, which, you know, means it works about as well as whatever else. I don't have the paper here, so I don't know what they were using. It's cheap. That's the big thing. You know, you hear about a new drug, you're always expecting it to cost an arm and a leg. This stuff is $30 for 50 pills on GoodRx. So I can really see this as making some substantial inroads into a real dilemma that we have with the opioid crisis right now. And I might add also with the pharmacies, the chain pharmacies, pretty much as a tactic so they don't have to deal with the paperwork, I think, but also obviously because of fines and other and scrutiny from the feds after the opioid crisis 10 years ago. They just have all sorts of tactics to stall and avoid giving people opioid pain medications. And it's becoming harder and harder to even get a prescribed medication at a chain pharmacy. And to avoid in a letter from any lawyers, I will not name who the chain pharmacies are. You know who I'm talking about. We are recapping the news of the year, the scientific breakthroughs in 2025 that stand a chance of changing our lives. We have a couple about gene editing that I hope we'll get to. The first one is K.J. Muldoon, who is a special little boy who was born in Philadelphia, and he's the first person to get gene therapy that was designed just for him. So it's the first time we have used the technology that we now have to identify what's wrong with a person who has a syndromic illness. And we'll talk about that in a moment. And then define the mutation, because it can be different in different people, and fix it. So KJ has what's called an autosomal recessive disease, which means he receives two bad copies of a particular gene called CPSI. That stands for the, here's the mouthful it stands for, carbamoyl phosphate synthesis 1. And it's a very important enzyme in the breaking down of urea. What the heck is that? Well, basically, urea is how you handle nitrogen. You know, we can turn our amino acids into fuel. And as we do that, we remove the nitrogen, and the nitrogen is a waste product. And so it's converted in the kidney to urea, or maybe it's the liver. I don't actually remember, but probably the liver. It gets converted to urea and then peed out, you know, excreted. And if it doesn't get converted, then you get buildup of ammonia. Ammonia, you know, the stuff that you use to clean your floors? Well, that's what comes off of the amino acid. It needs to be detoxified pronto. Otherwise, it will not only fry the liver, it will damage the brain. So without the enzyme, the ammonia levels shoot up and cause brain and nerve damage. And this is very, very rare. About 1.3 million people, but most of them die in early infancy, more than half. You can, in some cases, less severe than KJ's, you can give them a low-protein diet and other medications and a liver transplant. But KJ was premature this last August, and he was too small for a liver transplant. And medications and extremely low-protein diets helped, but there were doctors who happened to be where he was born, and it's amazing how well they mobilized this. How well and quickly they mobilized this. A team of academic and industry scientists, and they essentially genetically analyzed the particular mutation that KJ had. They figured out how to fix it, and how they fixed it is the rest of this story. Now, his therapy is based on CRISPR, which is a targeted gene editing system. In the case of KJ, he got a sort of molecular pencil eraser. The editor chemically erased the mutation and wrote in the correct DNA letter. These are called base editors, and they're being used for even things like high cholesterol. Musunuro is the company that is developing this sort of therapy, and he's one of the main researchers on this. So once they had what they had to do with CRISPR was get it into the body. So they essentially took the messenger RNA to teach the body how to make the CRISPR editor, and then injected it into his liver in the form of little tiny soap bubbles so that the mRNA was protected, because mRNA is very delicate. And this CRISPR base editor changed the incorrect A to the correct G. And I won't go into the details, but it's amazing because the body itself did the fixing. And what a difference an A makes, right? So once they had tested this in liver cells in the dish, they designed this for his specific mutation and gave it to him, and within 6 months, they had found the defect. They had fixed him, and he was discharged from the hospital. And he will have to be checked and followed to make sure that this takes. But we have a healthy child where we would have had a dead child. And we already have two approved gene therapies that work similarly. One of them is for sickle cell anemia, and the other is for beta thalassemia, a type of both of these cause anemia. Both of these are blood diseases, so you can easily, so it's easy to get to the blood to basically send the CRISPR in to do the thing. But this was the first one where they actually injected into an organ successfully. So that's a big deal, and it just opens up so much possibility. There are probably, when I was in medical school, oh, these many years, we learned about these. There was a book we had to read called Inborn Errors of Metabolism. And it was all about these really critical breakdown enzymes, or things that would accumulate in the body because the pathway that broke them down was not working. And so it was all about toxicity from our own created molecules that can only be present at certain levels. And when those levels go too high, it damages the brain. In the case of children with this particular deficiency, they are kind of lethargic and foggy right from birth, and they just don't perk up. And someone tests them and finds high ammonia levels in their blood. And I suppose we can take our hats off to the therapeutic acumen of the pediatricians in this case. Now, here's something a little more down to earth that I think we'll all get a kick out. Cancer treatments may get a boost from COVID vaccines. And there are implications that it may not actually just be COVID, but all mRNA vaccines. But how did they figure this out? Well, lung cancer patients who received the vaccine within a few months of immunotherapy, which revs up the immune system, lived nearly twice as long as unvaccinated patients. That came out in Nature in October 22nd. Scientists had already had clues about the anti-cancer effects of mRNA vaccines. An experimental mRNA vaccine given to tumor-bearing mice, for example, made immunotherapy drugs work even better. We think of mRNA vaccines typically as the immune system's teachers. For example, the COVID vaccines included mRNA that carried the code for assembling a harmless little bit of the spike protein. The body uses that mRNA to build the protein, like a blueprint, and the immune system then saw small amounts of it, said, you don't belong here, and developed antibodies against it. Antibodies made by those very plasma cells, by the way, that when they go out of whack, cause multiple myeloma. So mRNA cancer vaccines aren't, they encode snippets of tumor proteins rather than viral proteins, and the idea there is that you're going to use you're going to put that cancer protein, which, again, that shouldn't be there, and teach the immune system to make antibodies. But in this case, that's old news. In this case, it didn't include any mRNA. The vaccine had, it didn't include any tumor mRNA, but it still had anti-tumor powers. It still amplified the effect of the immunotherapy drugs, just giving the mRNA itself, not what it encoded, rallied the immune system through a mechanism that no one ever suspected and no one understands. But researchers have gone back in the last few months and they've analyzed the records of nearly 1,000 people with small cell lung cancer, all of whom received a type of immunotherapy called a checkpoint inhibitor. And nearly 200 of these 1,000 people had also received an mRNA COVID vaccine within 100 days of their drug treatment. Okay, let's go forward. Fast forward 3 years. Of those patients with cancer, 56% of those who received the COVID vaccine with the same checkpoint inhibitor were still alive, compared with 31% of the unvaccinated patients. And they also saw the same thing in patients with advanced melanoma. And this is just a complete surprise to the scientific community, and they're trying to figure it out. They think that maybe the mRNA vaccine acts like a 911 call that alerts the immune system to start fighting the cancer, sort of upregulating the immune response. It's too early to say whether combining immunotherapy with nonspecific mRNA vaccines will become the standard of therapy, but it's certainly the fact that this unrelated vaccine with no tumor protein in it actually amplifies chemotherapy, and this is cheap, widely available, tried and tested, FDA approved, all the good things. Maybe that's going to become the standard of care fairly rapidly. And if you are getting immune checkpoint inhibitors or other advanced chemotherapy and you haven't had your COVID shot, you might want to consider doing it just on spec. Let's move on to some more news that you can use from the 2025 breakthrough. This one we covered, but we'll cover it again because different people are listening. Shingles vaccination may help protect people from Alzheimer's disease. According to findings published recently in Nature, people who received the Zostavax vaccine, not Shingrix, but the older vaccine Zostavax, were 20% less likely to develop dementia over the next 7 years compared with those who remained unvaccinated. In many countries, Zostavax was later replaced with a more powerful and effective shingles vaccine. And Zostavax was an attenuated live virus vaccine, whereas Shingrix is a more standard vaccine where just a tiny little bit of the protein is in there and it's not capable of causing disease. But 20% less is a very, very big deal. We've been trying, I think, and we'd had hints in the research, but it was done on cells, it was laboratory animals, it was observation studies comparing people who chose to get vaccinated with those that didn't. And those are fundamentally limited because you can't control for other behavioral distances. So, for example, people who skip vaccines could arguably be people who had very different behaviors than people who get vaccines. Whether that would be for good or for bad, I'm not going to judge, but I will say that I'm very much in favor of getting all vaccines. And this data is going to get me off the dime on the Shingrix vaccine personally, which I've been stalling on, and I'll admit it. This reason this data is so strong is because when the vaccine became available in some years ago in Wales, the health department basically just decided, okay, we're not going to give it to people over 80 because it shows it's less effective in that group. So they just picked a birthday. And if your 80th birthday fell within a week of the vaccine cutoff, well, you were still 80 or 80 plus 1 week, but they had either gotten the vaccine or gotten the vaccine. And it was a large number. This is an entire country we're talking about. So virtually none of those who had a birthday in the week prior to the cutoff got the vaccine, while about 50% who had a birthday a week later got the vaccine. So then they compared the health outcomes over the next 7 years. And in the whole group, 1 in 8 people in total were diagnosed with dementia in that time. And those who received the vaccine were 20% less likely to develop dementia than those who didn't receive it. And we have data on herpes virus and dementia, herpes simplex. And shingles is, you know, herpes zoster. It's really a first cousin. Both of these are neurotrophic viruses. They're going to cause brain inflammation. And we have data about inflammation all over the place showing that people who have high inflammation tend to develop more dementia faster. So this would include people with autoimmune diseases, people with poorly controlled diabetes. And we see a kind of diabetes taxed in terms of earlier dementia, and that's been statistically known for a very, very long time. But now we have this very clear, beautiful, natural experiment. Now, will the other vaccine, the Shingrix, do the same thing? We don't know for sure, but because getting recurrent herpes, oral herpes outbreaks, nothing serious, is associated with more rapid development of Alzheimer's disease in people who already have it, I think it's a fair extension to say that it's the inflammation, and treating the inflammation, preventing the shingles, is going to have the same result as preventing the herpes has, which is to slow the rate of progressive dementia. Up until now, Huntington's disease has been a sentence to incurable, untreated descent into physical degeneration and eventually madness. It's amazing that research came out this year that showed that a treatment, brain injections for a virus that encodes for a segment of RNA, may have prevented the formation of the rogue proteins that make Huntington's so devastating. Now, this is very preliminary. It was announced this September, but over 3 years, the treatment slowed Huntington's progression up to 75%. And this is the disease that has no effective treatments or cures. Again, it's relatively rare, 7 out of 100,000 people, and it's the result, again, of a mutation of a single gene. In this disease, that gene, Huntington, it's called, is mutated in only one way. So the front end of the resulting protein grows, and this becomes a toxic protein. It aggregates in the brain and kills cells in the brain, especially in areas that are crucial for voluntary movements. Now, unlike Parkinson's, where people freeze, people with Huntington's actually end up looking spastic. They have increased involuntary movements, stiffness. They also have difficulty speaking and swallowing. They have cognitive decline. And unlike KJ's disease, Huntington's is genetically dominant. It only takes one copy of the defective gene to cause it. And because it's caused by slow accumulation of the toxic protein, it will never die out of the population voluntarily, because people won't even develop the first symptoms until after they've reproduced. Now, of course, if we have a genetic testing for it. But Ed Wild and his colleagues at the University College of Medicine in London collaborated with a Dutch pharmaceutical company called Unicure, and they created microRNA. Now, we've been talking about mRNA vaccines, so let me differentiate the two, because they both have an M. Okay, mRNA is a blueprint, and that blueprint gets made from the nucleus of the cell, carried out into the cytoplasm, where it gets hooked into this little clamshell called a ribosome. And the ribosome's job is to turn that blueprint into a protein. So it adds amino acid by amino acid, and we won't go any deeper into the process. But it has to be a single strand of RNA getting into the ribosome. So what microRNA does is you make the mirror image of that RNA, and the mirror image just clicks on. Remember, DNA is double-stranded. Well, you make a little bit of mirror image double strand, and when you drop that into the cell, the mirror image attaches to all of the mRNA for the Huntington protein. And it attaches it. Now you've got a little segment of double strand that gets caught and won't fit into the ribosome. You can't make the bad protein because you can't run it through the manufacturing apparatus. So how do you get that into the brain? Other studies had tried injecting these RNAs into the spinal fluid, but it didn't work. They couldn't get to the right areas of the brain. In this study, the scientists injected directly into the brain, and they packaged the microRNA into Viruses. Yes, viruses. And so a virus, what does it do? Well, it squirts RNA into the cell, and it acts like a syringe. So they filled up the syringe with anti-Huntington, and the virus just obediently went off where it was injected, infected cells, put the anti-Huntington microRNA in there. And so the neuron became, it reprograms the neuron to stop making the Huntington. Now, these were huge surgeries, 17 patients with early symptoms and a 12 to 18 hour process. And don't forget, they had to get needles stuck into their brains. So this was a very big deal. But following them for 3 years, those receiving the highest dose of the treatment saw an average of 75% less decline in their cognitive and motor symptoms. Some people actually recovered enough to go back to work. Others who would be, by the timetable of this terrible disease, they'd be in a wheelchair, they're still walking, and their symptoms appear to have stabilized. This is new information. Wild and his colleagues have been tracking a measure of nerve cell damage in the patient's CSF, levels of a protein called neurofilament light chain. This goes up after anything that damaged neurons, so it went up after the surgery, but then it drops. And if you have still had continuing damage from the Huntington protein, you would expect it not to go all, you would expect it to gradually increase. But what they've happened is that in the 3 years, the drop from baseline has stabilized. And that implies that they don't have increasing amounts of nerve damage. So we may not have cured Huntington's, but we've definitely turned back the clock and slowed the progress. And this is just the preliminary. I can't tell you how big this is and how important it is to science and to all of us, because sooner or later, we may need some of this advanced therapy, or someone we love may. And I am so pleased and happy to see that it's likely to be available. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.